This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk number 14. Now, I want to kickstart the show with a song from Trainspotting because this week there were pictures released online of the cast filming the sequel called Trainspotting 2, you may have guessed. I'm really excited about this. I love the original film. I've watched it recently and it still holds up. It's a bold, funny, gut-wrenching, visceral movie, and I just hope the sequel is good. Even if it's as half as good as the original, it'll still be a good film. One of the things I love about Danny Boyle is he's such a courageous filmmaker, and what I mean by that is he's got the courage to try things. You know, sure, there's a couple of films in his oeuvre, shall we say. That makes me sound smart or French. There's a couple of films in his canon that I'm not nuts about, but you get the feeling like he doesn't really care, like, whether it fails or not, that he just wants to try different genres, different films, and most of them are brilliant films. I'm sure he's sensitive to negative press or whatever, but you just feel like he's like, fuck it, let's just do this. I think you see that in his films. So I was going to try and work out which song from the original Trainspotting movie to kickstart the show with. And I was going through the soundtrack and there's so many. There's Perfect Day, Born Slippy, Lust for Life, Sing by Blur, which is a personal favourite Blur song of mine. So many good songs. And it actually got me thinking that there hasn't really been a movie in a long time that sort of completely captures the zeitgeist of popular culture. You know, like the way that Pulp Fiction did or Trainspotting. You know, where everyone's quoting the film, people are dressing like the characters, endlessly quoting and misquoting lines from the film. People have got the soundtrack, people are copying the artwork. Do you remember the Trainspotting orange artwork? Everyone was then into orange. And there hasn't been a film like that in ages. Maybe, fingers crossed, Trainspotting 2 will do that same thing again. Anyway, so many songs to pick from, so I just did the easy thing and went to the first track. This is Lust for Life, Iggy Pop.
Thank you. that I didn't realise quite how long that song was. It's about 5 or 6 minutes, and for a song that has zero chord changes, it's just like the same three. That's a pretty long time to be going on. But what a brilliant song. You know, I've just criticised it, but it's actually a brilliant song. Where do you stand on the whole Trainspotting thing, James? I have James Gill here from Shortlist Magazine, becoming my wife in crime.
Second banana is how I like to think of myself.
Oh, okay. I thought that was the way you were describing your excitement for Trainspotting. Second banana, to be honest. I thought it was a northern thing. Second banana.
So at Shortlist Magazine, we've just done, it's out now, folks, we've done an issue all about 1996.
Okay.
It's 20 years since that year
yeah.
of Trainspotting and TFI and the European Championships, mm-hmm. etc. If I'm honest with you, while Britain was going crazy for Britpop and Trainspotting, I was always more into the American stuff. So like while Oasis and Blur were huge, I was into, say, Pearl Jam and the Chili Peppers. Mm. So if I'm honest, I think Trainspotting is a really good movie, but I don't adore it in the same way that other people adore it. I didn't have the poster on my wall at university, for example.
No, I didn't have a poster on my wall, but because it's sort of, having a poster of a film like that is a little bit like having a Che Guevara t-shirt in
yes,
a way.
Absolutely.
It's a little bit a little bit naff.
I agree.
But the fact that it had such a cultural impact, like popular culture.
It was huge.
You know.
It was huge. I mean, that poster, my God, you know, it was iconic, wasn't it? Of the main characters mm-hmm. in that lineup doing those poses.
So it's hard for me to ask you this, if you hold hope for a sequel to be any good.
I'm sure the sequel will be awesome.
Are you a Danny Boyle fan?
Yes, I am, very much so. Good. And I love the fact that he can do so many genres.
Mm-hmm. And well.
Oh my goodness! I mean, I think Sunshine is probably my favourite Danny
Boyle
movie.
Some people are a bit hard on Sunshine for some reason. But
any film with Mark Strong in it is fine by me.
Okay, well, I mean, you're really clutching at straws with your Mark Strong link there, because he's sort of hardly in it, is he?
I think you know how much I love Mark Strong.
Yeah.
It's sort of like any excuse to crowbar Mark Strong into a conversation.
If you hear that there's a thanks to Mark Strong at the end credits of a film, you're going.
Yes, yeah. I'm there.
It doesn't matter how tenuous.
What I would say as well is there was a relatively unknown actor in that by the name of Chris Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And when you watched Sunshine, he was the guy who really jumped out, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
It was a real, whoa, hang on a minute, who's that guy?
Yeah.
And so to those of us who've loved Chris Evans for a while, it's perhaps no surprise to see him be awesome as Captain America.
And he obviously had such a hard time breaking through with his namesake. You know, it was really tough for him.
Imagine that.
Because Chris Evans, he's huge in the US.
The person I feel really sorry for is Bryan Adams. Because Ryan Adams came along and was...
Took his thunder, didn't
he? I mean,
he?
It's brutal. It will be like Rod Stewart thinking, I'm all right, and then a guy called Bod Stewart being even cooler.
Well, by the rule of Brian and Ryan, it would be Odd Stewart, wouldn't
Odd
it?
Odd Stewart.
And
if that isn't a tribute act waiting to happen. Sounds like a Kevin Eldon character, Odd Stewart.
To be honest, Odd Stewart is is kind of what Rod Stewart's become as he's got older, isn't it?
God bless him, yes. He has a toy train set, on the top floor of his LA mansion. And every time Rod needs some Rod time, that sounds awful. He goes and plays with his... This is not a euphemism, listeners. He literally... Google it. He plays with a toy train set.
I like that you're painting out a picture that it's probably some huge millionaire's train set, but I like the idea that it's just one little circle going round and
one
round.
One track.
Yeah.
Solitary train.
This is not
massive.
Film news,
sorry,
James.
Yes.
Come on. You're a film editor of a magazine.
But also, if you want some random trivia, I'm also your man.
Oh, okay. Okay. Are you good in pub quizzes?
Yeah, not bad.
Okay, so look, Trainspotting, that's a sequel that is 20 years, not in the making, but I think they've been trying to get it made in the last 5 years. But that's 20 years after the original.
Yes.
Is that the longest gap between sequels there's ever been?
Well, Dan, it's funny you should ask.
Seeing as you are the man with the trivia.
I would say off the top of my head, I reckon the time between Bambi, the original Disney classic, and what I believe was a straight-to-DVD sequel, Bambi 2, we are talking 63 years and 178 days.
Do you think for every one of those 63 years, people were going, when are they doing the sequel?
And then when it came out, finally! Imagine someone on their deathbed, yeah. just a sequel to...
Yeah, yeah. Or just as they're about to die, it's all they've ever wanted, and they're literally their last breath. Oh, news just came out, they're making a sequel. Dead.
Why? Yeah, that, I mean, that is bonkers, isn't it? Fantasia, the same.
Yeah.
Had to wait ages for a sequel. Fantasia 2000... Did you watch it?
No.
No, not a lot of people did. 59 years, 48 days.
Wow.
Incredible. There's a lot of... I'll be honest, I'll level with you, Dan. Yeah. I think we're friends now, I can be honest. Yeah. A lot of these are Disney cartoons with sequels that went straight to DVD.
Yeah, well, there's obviously money in it, right?
Yes. Cinderella, 51 years. Peter Pan, 49
okay,
years.
Okay, some more...
There's
that
a theme here.
More that we may know or be fans of. Any the ones off... You've actually got a list there. The ones off the top of my head, I doubt they're even in the list because they're nothing compared to 63 years. But I was thinking The Hustler, Colour of Money. Is that a sequel?
Yes, or is it that- is. That, you've got to say that's a sequel. Okay. And I tell you what, I re-watched The Colour of Money recently. Oh, what a movie.
Yeah?
Oh, it's so good.
I don't think it did very well at the time.
It didn't do that well. And I know that, I think it was Siskel and Ebert had really helped Scorsese on the comeback trail. They'd really championed him. He talks about this in that documentary, doesn't he?
That's right.
And they did not give it a great review. Yeah. And he said that that was his way of them saying, we'll help you, but when you know, you've still got to deliver the goods. But I think the Colour of Money is a minor classic.
I think it's brilliant. Brilliant.
And Cruise. I know we talk a lot about Cruise.
Yeah, because one day we'll come on.
Cruise's charisma in that movie and the famous scene where he's let go to his head and he's doing all the trick shots and Eddie Felsen is furious. I mean, crikey.
So not
two
a direct,
special movies.
Not a direct sequel. The Two Jakes, you know, that is the sort of semi-sequel to Chinatown.
I suppose similar deal, isn't it? In that it's a sort of sequel.
They're not. Where do you stand on, like, going beyond a trilogy?
Go. Oh, you mean the fact that, say, they're making Toy Story 4?
Yeah, that kind of thing. Because doesn't a trilogy just feel neat and like, that works. It's like three acts, comedy in threes, everything's good in threes.
I mean, this isn't really answering your question, but look at the Fast Furious movies. Because those movies are getting bigger and better, and we're approaching 9 and 10.
And actually, you could argue, I'm not necessarily a big fan of the Fast and Furious, but I know from watching and being into film that they kind of had a dip at one point.
They did.
Almost like, are you still making those?
Yes.
And now they're like, please still make those.
Yeah, that is so true.
It's really
you can
gone.
Imagine the studio going, all right, you can make another, whereas now, please, when are you making the next?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because those things just print money.
They make so much money. It's insane.
I've recently interviewed two of the directors, Justin Lin and James Wan. You think I'm enthusiastic? Yeah. Chat with those two. But those guys, thanks largely to those movies, their films, their entire catalogue of movies are in the billions. Mm. I mean, it's just incredible.
The one that really upset me was the Indiana Jones one.
Now, I would say, controversial, I would say Last Crusade is my favourite Indiana Jones movie.
I love Last Crusade. It's on a par for... I wouldn't say it's my favourite. It's on a par with Raiders.
The chemistry he has with Connery is... I mean, the bit where you think he's dead, or Connery thinks he's dead, and it's the line, I thought I'd lost you, boy.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Niagara Falls.
I think I went to see it twice at the cinema. Twice. Here's a little story for you.
Yes.
This is a kind of observation on humour and age, right? So one of the two times I went to the cinema to see it, I was sat with my brother, who's a couple of years older than me, and they did, I think it was the second time I went to see it, and he did, they first meet, Connery and Harrison Ford, he finally finds his dad, and then he says, where's the diary? And he went, oh, well, I brought it with me. And he went, because he was meant to, he sent it to him to get it away from the Nazis. And he says the line, I should have sent it to the Marx Brothers.
Hang on a minute!
Right.
That's good!
That is a good impression, right? And then, look.
Amazing, Dad! Stop it!
All right, I've got others.
You were a hero before.
Time.
You've become a god. That was amazing!
Calm down,
no,
James.
Calm down. Right, people listening, he did the face! All I can do is go, shoshajish. But you did the full... Oh,
I did the full face.
Can you
I
do
the full face. I did the full Connery. Roger Moore. Ah, Miss Moneypenny. There you go. So so he says, I should have sent it to the Marx Brothers. And then the cinema erupts with laughter. And this is the second time I've seen the film in about the space of a week or so. And I turn to my brother and I go, I just don't see, I knew who the Marx Brothers were, but I was like, I just don't see how that's funny. And my brother said to me, oh, you know, that's a joke for old people. When you're old, you'd probably like that. And I thought in my head, no, I fucking wouldn't. I know what's funny. I was about 12.
And then you rewatched it.
And then I watched it. It was on TV not long ago. And he went, I should have shunted to the Marx Brothers. And there I was chuckling away. And I was like, oh my God, I'm old.
Mate, that Connery, that is a gift for the ages. It really has.
Can I do anyone else? My daddy put this watch up his ass.
Ali G, fantastic.
Yes, good. Okay. So what news do you bring with you?
Okay, so Star Wars Episode 8, by all accounts, is in fine fettle. The director, Rian Johnson, has Instagrammed that they're on the home straight, so they've pretty much finished filming, and then the special effects will then take over, is incredible.
Do you think that the average punter is like, oh, I hope they wrap on time?
Well, what I would say is that your average punter probably is aware. The reason why this is more interesting is because, obviously, Rogue One, which is out in
a couple of weeks.
Yeah, which is out in 6 months, is having to go back in for extra shooting. So if I was working on Rogue One and I heard the news that Rian Johnson's pretty much done and dusted with this, you'd be like, you son of a gun. Now, obviously, a lot of films have reshoots, so it may not be that big of a deal. However, they have brought in Tony Gilroy from Michael Clayton and the Bourne movies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, who knows? Maybe the reshoots are bigger than we perhaps realised, or maybe it's all perfectly normal. What I would say is,
maybe they just want a shaky camera fight scene. So that's why they got him.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Bit of Mai Tai, hand to hand. But obviously, based on the trailer, Rogue One looks amazing.
So good. Maybe it's just not in the brand enough.
That's the chat. The chat is, it's because The Force Awakens was such an uber smash and felt like a continuation of 4, 5 and 6, maybe they're thinking that it doesn't quite fit in with those other four movies.
A bit too...
So apparently they're cranking up the laughs, whereas at the moment it's quite a somber...
Well, they should have got like
war movie.
They should have got some joke writers in rather than Tony Gilroy, shouldn't they? Who is brilliant, by the way. Tony?
It is
Tony. Yeah, they should have got some, some gag writers.
Dan and I would have done that for free.
Well, you might.
Sorry, I would have done that for free.
I would have at least asked for a travel card.
My agent right now is shouting at the radio. No, you wouldn't. I definitely would.
Also, you mentioned to me this morning, are you texting your agent, don't listen to today's podcast.
I am sorry for what I just said about Star Wars. So Warcraft, it's fair to say, has been met with some pretty middling reviews. It opens in the US this weekend, and predictions are that it may underperform. However, this isn't the first movie that has done incredibly well in China. So it's made something like $46 million in China already. It's on course to be an absolute uber smash over there. So again, what is interesting is that films that we may think are going to be something of a disaster can be rescued by the Chinese market. Mm-hmm. And also what you see are some studios pandering is maybe too harsh, but certainly, let's say, appealing to the Chinese market. So I believe it was Iron Man 3, who was written by our mutual dear friend, Drew, that's one for the regulars, Drew Pierce, that I believe had a special scene that was tailored purely for the China market.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, I think you can expect to see more of this, because these Chinese audiences have this voracious thirst for these big Western movies.
Yeah. You mean... like films made by the West, not Western movies.
Well, there's a Magnificent Seven remake out later this year, so you never know.
So maybe. Also, you were talking about... you texted me this morning that Game of Thrones is going to be the longest...
Yes, so longest the finale... episode. So I think this series has been excellent.
Can I just say, before we go...
Series.
I've not seen a second of it.
Producer, thank you. Are you up to date as well?
Yeah.
There we go.
It just, I'm not in, like, and I know what you're going to say. You're going to say to me, it's not like that. It's, you know, it's different. It's
go edgy. Go on. Do you not like anything that's
I just don't, not into wizards and dragons and things, you know.
It's funny because my wife is exactly the same. So we put on episode one, mm-hmm. and as soon as someone said, I know the word, amulets, she was like, turn it off.
Really?
That was it. Yeah, absolutely, straight away. Yeah. Good night. This series, good night, thank you. I'll be in the other room watching Towie on a tablet. For those of us who are watching, I think this season has been exceptional, and the finale is said to be the longest episode yet. Also,
26 hours.
26
long.
Hours of pure Thrones. Also, I don't want to spoil it, but they've released the titles of the remaining episodes. Listeners, check out the title for episode 9, and it is... Shall I say what it is? I'm going to say what it is. Okay. It's
turn off now if you don't want to
hear
the title. Turn off now,
because it is a spoiler.
Then switch back on in 15 seconds. Go.
So it's called Battle of the Bastards, which I think will
happens every Friday night in the...
North Leeds. which will be Ramsay, I believe, versus Jon Snow. And if you're a Thrones fan, that is, like, amazing.
The newsreader.
Yes.
So that's probably a joke everyone's done, because that's the first time I've heard that guy's name. I just want to tell me why it's so good in really layman terms.
You're a film fan.
Yeah.
Okay. I would say for you, it is shot beautifully. The characters are three-dimensional, and the dialogue is wonderful as well. There are storylines that you actually care about, and the great thing is, because there are so many characters, there are definitely going to be a couple of characters where you're like, I don't really care about those, but there are always going to be people who you really can hang your hat on. So even if you don't like one storyline, there's going to be another one coming any minute.
Mm-hmm. So like EastEnders,
you know what, it's a lot like EastEnders, but say Peter Dinklage, for example, is mm-hmm. is a big fan favourite, because he's a wonderful actor, and his storyline has been fantastic. There's someone that I know well, and I'm sure you know her well, Gemma Whelan.
I don't know her well. I know who she is.
So Gemma Whelan.
She's a comedian as well,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. So if you may have seen Gemma Whelan on the circuit as Chastity Butterworth. So mm-hmm. if you can imagine this prim and proper potty-mouthed Victorian schoolmarm smashing up the comedy circuit, and then to see her, can I say, lezzing off? But to see her lezzing off, if I could become a 15-year-old schoolboy again, on Monday night's episode was pretty jaw-dropping. But she is wonderful in it. She's great. Her and Alfie Allen are brother and sister. Right, listeners, bearing in mind they're brother and sister, can you remember what their first scene together was? Let's just say they were on a horse together. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Yes.
You clearly love your GOT, don't you?
I do think it's excellent. It's very well made. And as I say, I think the fact that they've created these characters that you care about so much is its greatest strength. It's almost irrelevant that it's set in this mm-hmm. fantastical setting. It is just great TV. And I think part of the reason why so many A-listers and big-name actors are wanting to make the move to television, because you can tell the story that is so much richer. Ian McShane, who we remember as Lovejoy, I think not enough time has passed for me to spoil Monday's episode.
Yeah, I think. Be careful.
Be careful.
Because I'm getting a lot of
really?
Angry tweets about your spoil. No, I'm not.
Oh!
I'm not.
Okay. Well,
see, I agree with you about the...
All I will say is you're getting some big names dropping in for small parts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with you about the TV is now... It's filling that space that cinema's no longer doing. So things like Breaking Bad, Sopranos, they were like classic... stories you would have told in, you know, the 70s cinema kind of
that's
era.
That's right, absolutely.
But now, like you say, you've got the time and opportunity to develop them and to go off in different directions. But it's a shame, because I feel like I would still like to see those films being made as well.
I agree 100%. And we must, you know, you and I, we love the films. We love going to the cinema. Mm. And so a film I saw recently, which takes us into the new releases, mm-hmm. is Conjuring 2. Mm-hmm. Now, Conjuring 2 is all about the famous Enfield hauntings that existed in the 1970s, where a girl may or may not have been possessed.
And did they do a TV version
exactly.
of this recently?
Exactly. So they did do a TV version over three episodes on Sky Living.
Yeah.
And you know what? It was excellent, because over the longer time period, you got to know these characters, you could go deeper into their backstories. It was a fantastic TV show, it really was. However, James Wan reminds us all that cinema is still king. So while he can't go as deep in terms of character development as the TV show did, because of the beauty of cinema and the beauty of the surround sound and the darkness, Conjuring 2 is still a wonderful cinematic experience that you still can't quite get on the small screen.
Is the Conjuring 2 based on the
Enfield? Okay. The first one isn't, but he follows two real life paranormal investigators,
right.
So they did actually exist, and they have loads of cases that they worked mm-hmm. on down the years. So hopefully if Conjuring 2 is also a success, there'll be many more chapters in this franchise to come. Patrick Wilson is the male lead, and if you're brilliant. A movie fan, I think we all have like a top 10 list of underrated actors and actresses mm-hmm. who we love. Patrick Wilson is just awesome.
He's brilliant. I love him in, was it called Lakeside? Is it Lakeside Terrace? It's the one with Samuel Jackson, who's like the cop next door.
Never seen it.
Going nuts.
Is it worth a watch?
It's like Pacific Heights and Unlawful Entry. There's loads of these films where there's a sort of stalker, crazy man, who, and people are like, is he crazy, is he not? But it's really good.
Sure,
mostly because of the performances. But yeah, check it out. James, thank you. The time's flown by.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
We will speak again, no doubt. Probably cuddle a bit.
I only come for the cuddling.
Yeah. This next song is from today's special guest. This is Tonight the Streets Are Ours by Richard Hawley from the film Exit Through the Gift Shop.
Got feelings in your heart. Don't let fear of feeling fool you. What you see sets you apart. And there's nothing here to bind you. It's no way for life to start. Do you know that tonight the streets are the streets are
beautiful song. So with me in the studio, I am delighted to introduce Doc Brown, otherwise known as Ben Bailey Smith. Which name do you go by?
I don't know, whichever you're happier with, really. I mean, you don't have to say the full name.
Is it two hats? I'm going to call you Ben Bailey Smith every time.
Doc's like a nickname I've had since I was in school, so either or, they both work. Some people are more comfortable with one than the other. I really have no preference.
I first was aware of you doing stand-up, and it was as Doc Brown. I was a little bit confused because of the other Doc Brown. Not the Dr. Brown, but the guy from Back to the Future.
Oh, right, yeah.
I was really hoping...
Yeah, I suppose it'd be easy to be confused with Dr. Brown because we were doing the same job at the same time. We even got each other's bookings.
Did you?
Occasionally, and we got each other's fans until we both really established ourselves and our styles, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anybody ever came expecting to see Christopher Lloyd perform 15-minute excerpts of Back to the Future.
That's why I turned up to the gig.
Never happened.
What made you pick that song, by the way? Great film.
I was on a plane once on route to a gig, and I'd heard about Exit to the Gift Shop. Mm-hmm. It sounded up my street. I watched it, and it starts off with footage of people bombing trains and stuff, mm-hmm. and that song plays, you know, obviously as a reflection of, you know, tonight is the streets belong to the bombers. But it hit me straight away, that song, and I was like, who's this? Obviously had to wait till the end credits to see who it was,
because on a plane,
on airplane mode and all of that. And I saw it was Richard Hawley, and I thought, oh yeah, I've heard of that dude, but I've not really heard any of his music. So obviously as soon as I was off the plane, I downloaded the song, and then got obsessed with it, and then I downloaded an album called Cole's Corner, mm-hmm. which is literally flawless from start to finish. And then I downloaded Lady Bridge, another album, and it's the same again. I mean, the guy is a powerhouse of that world of music. I don't really know how I'd describe it. It's like a little bit folky, a little bit...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of folk rock, indie.
Yeah, but it's very, very soulful, and the lyrics are superb throughout.
There's a sort of, it kind of reminds me of a cross between Morrissey and Roy Orbison, his voice.
I can see that. I can see that.
And a strange contrast.
It's very Sheffield.
Yeah, strange contrast to the actual documentary as well, the world that they inhabit.
Yeah, big time.
Do you love the film?
I love's strong. I enjoyed it, you know, but it's not like up there in my, you know, top 10 films. Yeah. Not even top 10 documentaries. I mean, it's good. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes
there's a tone to it where you're unclear throughout whether this is actually real or false, which is fine. But mm-hmm. it's when you're into documentary, it's a little bit like, actually, I want the facts. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's an element to it. It's a little bit of a frustrating watch, but it's definitely entertaining.
I think I've had that with a couple of films. The one that springs to mind was The Imposter. And I kept getting this feeling that the makers of the film had deliberately changed the order of events so that the story worked better.
I felt exactly the same about it. There was something not quite right, and not in a good old-fashioned unsettling way, which is what it should have been, because it's a very unsettling story, The Imposter. But yeah, I did feel...
Why is that, though? Because neither of us know for certain, but we both had feeling.
No, I had that feeling. It's very interesting,
like we're being manipulated.
To say that. And, you know, I'm totally up for being manipulated in a documentary to make it more entertaining. But like I say, there is an element, because I don't know if you're like me, but when I watch a documentary feature, I don't do it during, but I can't wait for the end to like wiki the shit out of it. Wiki the heck out of it, I should say.
You can, I think we're allowed to swear, aren't we, on this one? Yeah, I've got a pleasing wink from the producer.
You know, so there is an element where it's like, dude, just give me the facts. I don't mind if it might, in your eyes, let the story down a touch. But for me, it's like the truth is everything.
Is it, you know? Is it, do you like to, is it because you're fact-checking, or is it because you just want to know even more about it, or... I wiki the shit out of a documentary after I've watched it, just to see if everything happened the way they're saying it happened.
Sure. I mean, when it's most gratifying is when it adds even more, and you're like, oh my God, there could have been a sequel to this with all the other stuff that's happening. Like, you know... When you get to the end of the Jinx, and you realise the case is going on right now.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my God, I want to see like a day by day blow, you know, a feature length collection of what's going on now.
You want sent an hour update every day.
Yeah.
Personally.
But I think there is a fact checking element. I've long been of the belief that, you know, when we stopped becoming hunter gatherers, we just sort of moved into the realm of like hunting for useless information to make ourselves feel like powerful beings again.
And Hunter, but there's a have you seen the film While We're Young with Ben Stiller?
Yeah.
I really enjoy that film.
Mm.
Probably too much because of the sort of observation on age and stuff. But there's a moment where Ben Stiller, Naomi Watts, Adam Driver and Amanda Seyfried, they're all chatting away. They're the young cool couple and Ben Stiller's sort of in awe of them. And then they're trying to think of something like a fact. And then Ben Stiller goes to get his phone out and Adam Driver goes, no, don't, let's see if we can guess. And they try and guess and they can't. So he tries to find out and he went, no, let's just not know.
Yeah, that's really funny.
And it really blew his mind, the idea of not knowing, which I relate to.
Unacceptable.
Yeah.
It could have really easily been overly pleased with itself, that movie. And it just about stays.
It's on the cusp.
On the right side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for people listening who are trying to put a voice to a face, I mean, I'm sure lots of people know your work, but you are the co-creator and star of The 4 O'Clock Club. You starred in Law and Order. You were in Give Out Girls. You were the co-performer on Ricky Gervais's A Quality Street video, which is now, I was watching that this morning. It's fucking hilarious, by the way.
Thank you.
It's now on like just under 5 million hits on YouTube, which isn't bad at all, is it?
That's amazing.
It's not quite Gangnam style numbers, but it's not a billion, but that's pretty fucking good.
That's good.
And I believe you'll be reprising your role with Ricky on his upcoming film. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, Equality Street really was the sort of jump off point for the movie Life on the Road. And, you know, Ricky always talked about doing it, but I never thought it would come to fruition.
So he was talking about it when you were making that?
Yeah. Ricky's always thinking about the next project, you know. And, you know, when we wrote Equality Street, we also wrote another 6 or 7 songs together.
Oh, brilliant.
So we were always thinking of, like, maybe doing, like, an album, like a weird sort of buddy story album.
With the two characters.
With the two characters, you know. We were thinking about doing gigs, and we did do a few gigs in character.
Yeah.
But he always had one eye on you know, bringing Brent back for a full-on movie.
How did you get involved in that in the video? Because it was a charity single.
We did
it
for Comic Relief.
Yeah. Right.
So I guess it all started in 2012 when Ricky phoned me out of the blue. I'd never met him before, but it turned out we had a mutual friend who worked in live comedy, who'd shown him some YouTube clips of me doing stand up. So he called me, got my number, and called me and asked if I'd open for him at some gigs.
And your stand-up is predominantly rapping with sort of jokes? Is that how you would describe it in a crass?
It's predominantly just stand-up, but there it is peppered with, like, the odd rhyme, basically.
Okay.
So maybe in 15 minutes there'll be 3 sort of one-minute moments of, like, spoken word rap.
Yeah.
I'll talk about rap sometimes. It's just part of my life, isn't it? So, but it is just stand-up, really. So I went and opened for him out in Oslo and Stockholm. We went around Scandinavia a little bit, and we were there.
How were they? What were they like as an audience?
They were amazing. I mean, I'd gigged over there before, and their English is impeccable.
Yeah.
But, you know, also the world is a smaller place, what with YouTube and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're into British comedy, it's not exactly, not like it used to be. Like, you can just watch anything. So people are more than ready to see a Ricky Gervais gig pretty much anywhere in the world. And we did a couple of warm-ups, and we played the Spectrum in Oslo, which is it's just under 8,000 people.
Wow.
And then we played the Ericsson Globe in Stockholm, which is 13.5.
It's amazing, isn't it? Playing that many people in another country.
I mean, that's bonkers.
Yeah.
That place was full. But after the gigs, you know, we went and had some beers, and he was telling me about this show that he was devising called Derek. And he showed me a little video that he'd made of this character. And I was like, oh, okay. And he was like, yeah, I'm trying to make a like a six-part series. And he was like, but I want to crowbar you in somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you know, when we get back to London, come hang out. And
has anyone ever said that sentence ideas. To you? I want to crowbar you in?
Yeah, more than once, surprisingly, really? In various different situations, which I can't really get onto on radio. But yeah, we went back to London, and sure enough, you know, I went around there and he devised, you know, four or five episodes, and he was like, look, I want to write one around a character mm-hmm. for you. We'll work it out. So we came up with this character, a dude who was, you know, on doing community service, basically, in the yeah. old people's homes. That gave me a reason to be there. And we'd sort of developed one episode together. So that was the first time we sort of properly knuckled down and worked together. And during that process, you know, we talked a lot about how we were both sort of failed musicians, you know, and that made it just made us laugh to ourselves talking about our experiences and trying to get in the charts and stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, he said, why don't we just, you know, muck about and write some songs and get the guitar, you know. And that was it. We just started improvising, you know, around his place and putting little ideas together, and Equality Street was one of the first sort of two or three songs that we wrote. And he said, we gotta do a video. We should do it as Brent with like a rapper who doesn't want to be there kind of thing. Yeah. And that was it. He called Richard Curtis, gave us some money to make the video, and then we put it out for Comic Relief, because he was like, look, if I bring Brent back for that, you can't really criticize it because it's for Comic Relief. And that's the kind of thing you see at Comic Relief, you know, classic characters doing
something
different. But
it was still so so right, you know, it still had so much of that original David Brent essence. It didn't feel like something that was like, oh,
exactly. And the response was so sort of overwhelmingly positive that gave us the confidence to say, oh, well, let's maybe look into doing like taking this story further. Like, what are these two guys really about? And we got in Tom Basden, who I'm sure you know, playwright and screenwriter,
brilliant writer,
brilliant comedian, just all round brilliant man.
Sketches with you guys as well. Did he do all
He was in the sketch and Comic Relief, and we sort of just retained his services, and we started working up some ideas for the script together, and just improvising the three of us in a room and mucking around, and eventually got this script together. And we went into shooting at the end of last year. Really quick shoot over like sort of 5 weeks, really, and a lot of music, a lot of gigs. We got in a proper band. Andy Burrows came in from Razorlight and sort of kind of MD'd all the music, and we recorded the soundtrack at the same time. And Tom plays like a reluctant sort of sound engineer.
Yeah,
but he was just a great soundboard in general for comic ideas, and he's a brilliant actor too. So
sounds like a dream job.
To be honest, I've been on maybe been on maybe 20 shoots, but that one was the one where it was like, okay, I was born to be a part of this.
Yeah,
you know, I get to rap, I get to improvise, I get to act, I get to write, and I get to genuinely sort of be on tour, because we were performing in all these different venues, traveling with the band, and you know, we drank all the prop drinks, basically all of them.
You're literally living the dream.
It was beautiful.
So how long were you a musician before you got into comedy and acting?
About 11 years.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's it's weird with music. I always feel like it's unfairly that age is somehow a currency in pop music. Like, you can be old if you made it when you're younger.
Yeah,
like
that's fine.
Bruce Springsteen still releases an album when he's in his 60s, but if a new guy on the scene in his 60s turned up,
Steve Brockstein
people,
I think the only dude is probably C6 Steve.
Yeah.
Is that his name?
Yeah. He's kind of country blues.
Yeah, he came in old. He came into
but
getting
that
old.
Sort of but blues thing is, has to be. You can't be a young. What no, young person knows
about
the blues?
Your troubles. No. That's the beauty of stand up, though, isn't it? Really,
Definitely.
The more sort of haggard and unattractive you are, the more.
That was always my problem.
The more chance you've got, I think, of people believing in your troubles.
Yeah. I think they wanna hear from someone that's sort of anti-establishment or low status, or they don't
Or they want to feel your vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly. And you're still doing stand-up
occasionally.
Sounds
I
like
mean
you're busy
it,
doing
I don't
this.
Really have time.
Yeah.
That's the main thing. And I think with stand-up you're kind of all in, like, you know, you gotta be ready to go anywhere in the world, and you've got to be able to give up a lot of time for travel. You know, mm-hmm. people think, oh, stand up, you know, you can do 20 minutes of work a day. But it's the travel that kills you. And I need to be around because I'm contracted to do so much other stuff now. So I will come back to stand up, you know, in earnest, but not this year.
At what point in your music career were you thinking, maybe I should be funny rather than...
I never thought that.
No?
I never thought it even once.
Did someone say to you, you do realise what you're doing is funny?
Yeah, exactly. So what happened was...
And you're like, I'm burying my soul here, guys. What do you mean it's funny?
I had a friend who used to work at Radio 1 who got back in contact with me at the end of 2007. And he'd gone into writing comedy. Mm. And he'd written a vehicle for Lenny Henry with like an all-black cast for Radio 4. And he called me up out of the blue and he was like, do you think, would you be up for like just looking over this script for me? Because, you know, kind of a white guy, I feel a little bit awkward about some of the dialogue. And, you know, I just think you could help out. Yeah, I get the BBC to give you a couple hundred quid, and I was like, "Yeah, okay, cool, whatever."
Fact checking again, weren't you?
Yeah, very much so. So I went in there and I did what anybody would do, you know, with no real knowledge of comedy other than I'd seen sitcoms on television, just like anybody else. So I just thought, oh, you know, well, you can't say that. You really can't say that if it's at 6:30 on Radio 4. You could say this, but I think it'd be funnier if he said it like this. And I don't believe that someone would say that kind of thing. You know what anyone would do. And then, you know, got my 200 quid and that was that. But then I got a call from the producer saying, we actually think we quite like you to work the whole series as a kind of script consultant. Yeah. And I met Lenny and he was like, oh my God, I can't believe it's like, there's no black writers at the BBC, you know, so important that you're here. And I was like, well, I'm not a writer, like,
and I'm not at the BBC.
Yeah, and, but I ended up working the whole series. Lenny started giving me little speaking roles, and then you know how it goes. I started doing the same thing on other Radio 4 shows, just writing gags and helping out. And on some shows, I'd write little songs, silly jingles, if there were shows that needed comic songs.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was at that point that one of the senior producers there said, "You know, why? I don't understand why you don't perform comedy because you can write funny songs, you can clearly write gags, you've been doing that, and you're a performer, you know, it's like a no-brainer." And I was like, well, because I'm not a joke, like I'm a serious guy. You know, I still had that musician head on. And he talked me into going down to this night and you know, telling my story in a humorous way, and that's how it started.
And did you get a bit of that hit when you got a room going and you were like, actually this
I didn't get any laughs at all, but I didn't
why did you go back?
Because he asked me to. He asked me to come back and like actually structure some jokes. So I just went up and did what he said. I told my story.
Yeah.
And he was like, that would have been really interesting if it was a talk.
Yeah.
But, you know, you need to make people laugh.
You need some gags.
And I just didn't feel... I felt no awkwardness or pain at people not laughing because I just had no reference point. I'd never watched stand-up.
Yeah.
Like, I've never been into stand-up. So, like, I was just, like, there telling my story and people were like, oh, right. There was no moment where you felt death in the room because people were like, he seems really happy
seems
with
okay.
himself.
Yeah,
he seems really okay. Like, there must be like a big...
And you got a clap.
There must be like a big twist at the end that's hilarious. And then I was just like, all right, thanks, bye. And they were like, who was like what was that about?
Maybe the joke's like later tonight or something.
So yeah, it kind of started that
helps way. Having complete
Definitely.
Fearlessness.
There's no doubt it helps because that same summer I got to the final of So You Think You're Funny. That and I'd never written a joke.
Wow.
I'd never written anything for myself. I was just getting up there and going, okay, so now that bit of the story, if I truncate that's got a funny bit there. Yeah. This bit's got a funny bit there, then I'll do this little rap here. And that's all I did. 7 minutes was all you needed. I got all the way to the final. And then by then, there was industry people going, I'll book you to do this, I'll book you to do that. And all of a sudden, I was a professional stand-up.
In fact, that was where I saw you. Were you in the same final as Sarah Pascoe?
Josh Widdicombe.
And
Ahir Shah, Daniel Sloss, Daniel Simonson.
And Sean Walsh.
Sean Walsh.
Yeah.
Like I looked at the list all the way back to when Alan Davis won the first one in 91. And ours is the only one where everybody's working. Like, it's like a household name today.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's incredible. So it's great
Good
competition.
Good pedigree. Yeah. So what are you doing at the moment? What kind of stuff are you working on?
Well, I'm mainly just acting, comedy and drama. Yeah. You know, those are the main things, TV and movies. And
did that come off the back of the stand-up?
That came from stand-up, yeah. Because, you know, as soon as you're up there on stage doing stand-up, you realise you're writing and acting. You're writing script and you're mm-hmm. acting. That's what you're doing. And it was exactly the same as a rapper. I was writing script and acting it out.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can do this. And the big game changer was when I created that kid show for CBBC in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were like, and you're going to be in it, right? And I was like, I don't know about that. Like, I'm not really an actor. And, you know, the same thing happened again. I just got encouraged to do it. And actually, it was the DP on that. It was the director of photography who was, you know, operating the camera. And he was the one who was really like, the way you just did that was perfect. Or he'd say, like, the way you just did that, it's too big. Like, wow. You don't need to.
Did the director not get annoyed with the DOP doing all that?
No, because it's like that. So I know how much, I'm sure you did How Not to Live Your Life, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you know about the process. Sometimes on longer formats, which a lot of children's television is, like 13 episodes.
Yeah.
You get just like loads of different directors. Yeah,
like one.
So there's not really a director who's like, this is my baby. Whereas the DP is like, it's the same DP on five series. Yeah. You know? So you're not telling him shit.
Yeah.
And he was a really cool guy as well. So he'd just make these little. And also, you know, even though I was the number one on it, I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. Yeah.
And the proximity,
so it was really helpful.
He's always there, right there. So you can have that.
I sort of credit him with being like my acting coach.
Wow.
Because, you What's know, I was name? Fresh off stage. His name is Dougie Hallows.
Yeah.
He's
people are going to be
he's
right.
a bit of a legend in the Northwest, you know.
People are going to be right. Actors are going to be writing to him for mentorship. You know, can you help me with my acting?
Yeah. So he was the one who could just spot straight away, like, I'm bringing too much of the stage to the set. You don't need to shout. Like, the mic's going to pick you up, you know.
That's amazing.
Your eyebrows don't need to go that high just because you're surprised. You know? So I can. He's like, I can read how you feel. You just think about how you're feeling when you say that line. I'll do the rest.
You'd be surprised how few directors will help someone with that. They'll either a lot of people go.
Every director expects you to be fully formed when you're there.
Yeah, yeah.
So I mean, I went from that job. It gave me the confidence to audition. I auditioned for this HBO series to play like a hitman, and they sent me, you know, the sides.
And was this put you? Did you put yourself on tape, or did you go over there?
They had me in the room,
right?
But I was so green, I didn't even really understand the. Like, here's your sides, like whatever. So yeah, whatever. Like, I was just reading the date and the time that I need to be in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So I get there and they're like, okay, and I was like, I don't really know, like, what you guys want to do. Like, you want to have like a chat, or you want me to do some like improv or stuff? And they were like, no, we want you to do the fucking lines. And I was like, yeah, that's the thing. I was just like, there was no script or anything. And they were like, we sent you two sets of sides. I was like, oh, sides.
Oh,
is that like, okay, right. And I was just sat there thinking, okay, I've completely screwed this. This is great.
What
and,
did you think the sides were then?
I don't know. I just did. Like, that's just that. I just didn't. I often producer Nat will tell you I skim the shit out of emails. So,
yeah.
I just like. I don't know. I just sat there and thought, I've screwed this. And they just gave me the sides, and they were like, okay, well, look, read.
Yeah.
You know. And I just was so angry with myself. I just, you know, I read through them just. Think, just get me out of here. It's such a wasted trip. Get me out of here. I was so pissed off. And
the
then a couple of weeks later, I got the call. And they were like, yeah, we want him. And I couldn't believe it. And all I can imagine was that I was so livid with myself, but holding it in, that they thought this guy could be a psychopath. Do you know what I mean? He could be a hitman. And so I played, you know, I wasn't skilled enough to do a big, angry Al Pacino type hitman. Mm-hmm. So I played it like that. I was very, very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I never shouted, but I took out like 200 people over the course of that series. Wow. I blew up a building.
It's amazing. What was the show called?
It was called Hunted.
Oh man.
It was an HBO thing for BBC One in 2010.
You've just set a terrible example to lots of actors out there who are now going to not turn up having read their script.
No, listen, that was when I was very green, and now I work really hard to prepare, you know, especially on projects that I really, really want.
Mm.
Those are the dangerous ones, actually, the ones you really, really want.
Oh, man, it's so hard. Because how I often think, especially because I do stand-up as well, and often with stand-up, I think I'm always at my best when I care the least.
Oh, but yeah,
how
there's
do
no question.
You trick yourself into not caring when you want something so bad? It's like that weird
psychological
battle.
I don't
battle.
Know if there's a simple answer to it, you know.
If there is, let me know straight away.
I auditioned to play the young version of an iconic character from one of the most iconic movies in movie history recently. Right. And I won't tell you any more than that. I can tell
no
you.
No pressure then.
Perhaps. And I couldn't tell you how much I wanted it. But I had to try and act like it was nothing. And it was really tough. And the audition went really well.
Yeah.
Obviously, I didn't hear
really
anything.
Know.
But I don't know if maybe they saw something behind my eyes that just said, nah, he's not quite ballsy enough.
Really?
For this, so you just never know. But
can you give us a hint?
I think I gave you all the hints I could possibly give you.
Now you're a huge film fan. You've even you've written about film yourself and presented shows. You have presented me with a guilty pleasure that now this puts me to shame because I've never seen this film. And when I got told this is the film you were picking, I then thought, well, great, because one of the things I love on this show is that I get
discovering
to watch
new things.
Yeah. But I couldn't find it anywhere. It's nowhere to be seen. And I'm starting to think you've made this up.
Even
shot a fake trailer that they put on YouTube.
If you come to it cold, it's hard to believe that it exists.
So. Oh, man. Well, tell everyone exactly what the film is.
Well, it's a film by the renowned director Tommy Wiseau, and it's called The Room. It's an absolute shambles of 90 minutes. Based around a sort of crumbling relationship between a very creepy, possibly Austrian middle-aged man and his attractive
sort of hard to know where he's
age.
From, isn't it?
Yeah, he claims he's from America.
Right, he's
but
definitely not.
I don't know what state that is. But he is a state. He is a state himself. And this was a movie that gained cult status because it was obviously released as a taut. Emotional drama, and it's laugh out loud hilarious from start to finish. When it became a cult via clips being put out on YouTube, Wiseau did an about face and claimed that it was a black comedy and that he always planned it to be funny.
I love that.
And he's kind of desperately standing by that, but it is. It's top to toe hilarious.
Let's give the listeners a bit of a taste of.
Yeah, you should get a sense.
Yeah,
of
you
the
get
tone
a sense of
these.
This.
Oh, man, I just can't figure women out. Sometimes they're just too smart. Sometimes they're flat-out stupid. Other times they're just evil.
It seems to me like you're an expert, Mark.
Who's that? Is that the character from The Simpsons?
So, yeah, I should have set that up a little bit better. The American voice you heard there was the character Mark, who's played by Greg Sestero. And the crazy voice, it seems like you're an expert, Mark. That's Tommy, the writer, director, and star. They have a series of nonsensical conversations about nothing in particular.
A lot of them about women, though.
Yeah, because
they?
the thread of the story, as far as you can grasp it, is that they're involved with the same woman.
Right.
And there's secrets and lies. But they just nothing's followed through. The script writing is all over the place, and bizarrely, throughout, characters throw an American football to each other when conversing.
No yeah,
there's no rhyme or reason for that.
Bit of business.
It feels like it was an improv game or something that they just took.
What your turn to speak when you?
There's
get
even
the
a
ball.
Scene where they all show up in tuxes.
Yeah,
to the same you know.
For no
I mean,
reason.
Everything's pretty much shot in one room, and there's one scene where they do show up in tuxedos, and you feel like this was related to a party, perhaps, that they got cut from the movie, but they just couldn't be asked to cut all the bits because there was some gold in the tuxes. So
when I watched it, I watched the trailer on YouTube, Check it out, people. The Room. And this isn't Room, the recent Brie Larson movie. The Room. Put that into YouTube. The trailer alone is hilarious. I thought it was like a porn film without any sex.
There is sex. Is there sex? There's quite explicit sex in it.
But it's the sort of, it's that porn acting. Like when the delivery
man.
Yeah,
it is like porn acting. Like you expect it to be full blown sex within a minute, but it isn't. It's a genuine attempt a cinematic masterpiece. And it's so ill thought out that it becomes brilliant.
What is The Room in question?
Well, that's another big question. There's so much set up and literally nothing followed through that, you know.
Why is it a guilty pleasure for you? Do you?
Well, because there's no question. It's the worst film ever made.
Right.
I think it beats out Ed Wood and all of that stuff that's sort of well recognized. Because there's no excuse in the modern age when you can make a movie on an iPhone.
Yeah.
For a film to be this technically awful, there's just no excuse.
But you enjoy watching.
However, it is very, very enjoyable. I had a similar experience recently when I was on a rival film show on Five Live. I had to watch a bunch of new films, and there's a movie out this week called Misconduct with Al Pacino and Sir Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, which
and is... it is almost the Room level. Incompetent in the filmmaking, but with a huge budget and big stars, it's laughably bad. And you laugh all the way through. And it's supposed to be a taut legal thriller.
Wow.
With Ben Duhamel in the lead role, Alice Eve. Decent people.
Yeah, I know.
But it's a shocking mess. Jeez. I mean, lines that mean nothing. There's a moment where the woman says to Hopkins. Now, I know this might be hard for you, but I need you to stay as calm as ice.
Wow.
That's not a phrase. That's not something that people say.
It is now.
There's a lot of that in Misconduct. I'd highly recommend that as a guilty pleasure
Which is more pleasurable and which is more
The Room's
guilty.
More pleasurable because it's got more laughs to the minute than most comedy films you'll ever see.
Yeah.
Whereas Misconduct, you're it's more of a thing of wonder where you're just like, wow, this is a multi-million dollar movie with two Oscar winners.
What were Al and Anthony talking about in between takes? Were they like,
yeah, I mean, I shudder to think. Yeah, there's some amazing lines from them as well. Anthony Hopkins at one point says really threateningly to a guy, "You want to talk a deal?" I don't think that's a phrase. I don't think anybody's ever said
They're inventing
before,
phrases. Inventing that's what you're phrases. Missing. You're missing that they're trying to, you
fantastic,
know, push
fantastic,
the envelope with phrases.
But The Room is unbelievably awful. And the archetypal So Bad It's Good movie, I'd say.
Well, I'm going to hunt it down. Thanks so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
No, pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Good luck with everything you've got coming up. And I can't wait to see the David Brent movie.
Yes, August 19th.
Yeah, man. That's amazing.
Yeah, and I'm sure you'll be talking about it on the show. Maybe I'll come back and...
Definitely. Well, thanks very much. Why don't you introduce your final song and tell us why you picked this one as well.
Okay. Well, first off, I sent these in a while back and I've completely forgotten what my second choice is.
This is Nothing On Me by Kurt Smallfield. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, this is a movie that is sort of renowned for its soundtrack. I'd say the soundtrack's probably outdone the movie over the years.
Probably,
the movie
yeah.
is Superfly, obviously a very sort of legendary blaxploitation film. Not a great film. No. However, Curtis Mayfield's soundtrack is unforgettable from start to finish. I mean, everybody will recognize the song Superfly and the bass line from Pusher Man.
Amazing, really, when you think about the film it's scoring.
Yeah, really low budget, quite dodgy movie. But there's one song about sort of being free from the, the imprisoning effect of hardcore drugs called No Thing On Me that just sort of celebrates clean living, which is something that I've always aspired to. And it just fills your heart with joy, this song. There's no other way of describing it. From the wind chimes onwards, it's just a thing of beauty.
Well, that's why I decided we should play out on this. It's a beautiful song. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
I've met many people over the years, and in my opinion, I have found that people are the same everywhere. They have the same fears, shed similar tears, dying so many years. The oppressed seem to have suffered the most in every continent, coast to coast. Now our lives are in the hands of the pusher man. We break it all down in hopes that you might understand how to protect yourself. Don't make no profit for the man. I'm so glad I've got my own. So glad that I can see. My life's a natural high. The man can't put no thing on me. I'm so glad I've got my own. So glad that I can see. My life's a natural high. The man can't put no thing on me. You're something kind of funny. How the man take your money. He's shrewd as he can be. In such a way you'll never see. It's a terrible thing inside. Has died. The weaker turn to dope and put all aside their hope. And I'm so glad I've got my own. So glad that I can see. My life's a natural high. The man can't put no thing on me. I'm so glad I've got my own. So glad that I can see. My life's a natural high. The man can't put no thing on me.
Jump.